My name is Hallie Knipp. I'm a graduate student with Special Collections and Archives at Clemson University. I'm here today, June 22nd, 2023, with Dr. Robert Geist. Today we'll be discussing the formation of Clemson's Computer Science Department and the transformation of it over the years. Dr. Geist, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Sure.
Thank you. Okay, so can you tell me just a little bit of background info, like where did you grow up? Where did you go to college?
Oh, okay. Well, I was born in Florida, but we moved around a little bit as my father was completing medical training. So he's a physician, and I grew up most of my life in just outside Chicago in a suburb called Joliet. And went to high school there, and then went off to undergraduate at Duke in North Carolina, and then graduate school at Notre Dame, and more graduate school back at Duke. So it was a long trip through three graduate degrees, but it was all worth it, I think.
And I was looking at your CV online. You got a master's in computer science after you got a PhD, correct?
Yep. Computers were not prevalent as I was going through school. When I was an undergraduate at Duke, there was only one computer science course available, and that was intro. And so even by the time I finished graduate school, there was not much being done in computing. But a few years later, it all took over, and I really enjoyed it, what I was doing. I was a math professor at the time. And so I enjoyed what I was doing, and so I went back to school. I still knew some people at Duke from my days there, and it was close by. I was a professor at UNC Pembroke, and I went back to Duke was close, and so I was able to go back and take a few courses there, and then they asked me to join the faculty there, so I decided that I'd have more fun doing that, so that's what I did.
Fair enough. How did you come to Clemson?
Well, I was planning to stay at Duke, and I was enjoying that, and I had just been promoted at Duke. It was in 1983, and then there was a big change. The administration, the senior people, as I told you before, I don't want to name any names on any categories, but the senior people at Duke at the time in the administration decided that computer science was going to become VLSI, a very large scale integration. That is, we were all going to do chip design. And I didn't want to. I read a book on chip design, and I found it boring. I didn't want to do it. And so I said, I don't want to do this. So I started looking around for other places, and Clemson was just a nice place. I mean, it's a wonderful place to live, and good schools for my kids, and they made me an offer to join the faculty at Clemson that was just great. It was more money than I was making at Duke, and I was the first person ever to walk in the door at Clemson with tenure. And that kind of confidence in me was really made me sit up and take notice. And so I said, yeah, let's do this. And so they had a good administration at Clemson, that the dean and associate dean were very supportive, and basically said, do your research, publish a lot of papers, bring in money, we'll be happy. And so they didn't want me to focus on VLSI or any particular thing. They just said, do what you want to do and do a lot of it, and we'll be happy. So That's what I did.
All right. Can you tell me a little bit about what your research was at the time?
Well, I was in stochastic modeling of computer systems at the time. So performance and reliability modeling of computer systems, both hardware and software. So the reliability of flight control electronics and things like that. So which makes me shudder to this day. I understand that they're still using our software for reliability of flight control systems. So there you are. I did a lot of that for a while, and then there were opportunities to branch in other areas at Clemson. So I became enamored with computer graphics and special effects for the video and film industry. So I started pursuing that, and in effect switched research into that. And so moving around in a lot of areas, which is not a thing you want to recommend to assistant professors, but I was doing what I wanted to do, and that's that, you know, do what's fun. That's what I was doing.
Yeah, so digital imaging, obviously, in the early 80s was pretty new. Can you tell me a little bit how you got interested in that and what it was like at the time, and the changes you've seen in that particular part of the field?
Well, it's been a huge difference, of course, and I got started in it on it with I read an article by Don Knuth, who's a founder of computer science, and he had a really interesting article on digital halftoning, and that is how do you make an image that's all zeros and ones, black and white for a newspaper print or something that resembles something you can recognize. And so I read his article, and he writes beautifully, all his papers are wonderful. So I read his paper, and then I thought, you know, I could apply some of my stochastic stuff to see if I can improve upon this. And so that's where I started in on it, producing papers in digital halftoning. But then it branched into lots of other things. And I was teaching graphics at the time, and intro to graphics. And I had a lot of students who were really didn't want to know about the theory behind computer graphics or the mathematics, but more wanted to apply computer graphics to special effects, because that was just coming on in movie industry. And so I started looking into that and meeting people in the industry, and so got off into special effects that way. And special effects is just changed incredibly. I mean, it almost everything anymore can be done virtually. Way back when, though, it was what could you fake in things. So I still remember some of the early fakes that like waterfalls in some of the Star Wars things were people pouring salt and being photographed pouring salt over a fake cliff. And and Jumanji, if you remember that movie from long ago, and when the monster drags the police car into the woods, and pulls the car through the woods, all the woods shake. They had people hidden in the woods shaking the branches. Okay, I mean, that stuff wouldn't be done that way anymore, but that's the way it was early on, because it wasn't capability. Now there's the capability to do all those things. So,
so you mentioned you were making contacts in the film industry. And I know you eventually worked yourself in the film industry. Can you talk about that process and how it's affected your teaching and your career path?
Well, the people in industry who are basically in the borderline between academia and their industry were in effect doing research there. And there are some really brilliant people out there in industry. And so talking to them and seeing what they're doing was really instructive, and bending my instruction towards the kind of research that they were doing was, I think, really helpful to the students and to the industry as well. So I met people both initially at Industrial Light and Magic, and as ILM that is in so many movies, and then worked a lot with Rhythm and Hues and DreamWorks, and somewhat later with students who went to Disney. And Weta in New Zealand was always great fun, because they're always regarded as such a top flight special effects house. And in some of my graphics research, I was going to New Zealand anyway to visit my son. He's a physician and he was working there in a clinic for a year. So I was going there to visit him, and so I thought, well, as long as I'm going, I might as well talk to these guys at Weta. So I knew one of them from research discussions, and so offered to give a talk there, and I did, and then that led to further discussions, and they're just a lot of great people at Weta too. So I had kept that up. In fact, it was last year. I was still doing some work for them, remotely, of course. But I've been to New Zealand 3 times, and enjoyed every time. It's great fun.
I'd imagine. I would assume that's the company that you did work for The Hobbit with.
Yep. Yep.
Okay. Can you tell me about that experience?
Weta is the name of the company. It's also, they got it, it's, there's an insect that's native to New Zealand. It looks like a giant grasshopper, and it's about the size of your hand.
Oh my gosh.
Oh yeah, they're monstrous. So that's the name, that's where it comes from. Anyway, Weta Digital is the company, and they're still doing lots and lots of things. And so most recently, Avatar, all the Avatar movies.
Can you tell me about your experience working on the Hobbit film?
Well, that was great, great, great fun. I spent quite a while there, and I don't recall how long it was, probably about 6 weeks. And my task was normal map filtering. Okay, so what that means is that when actors are in any of those action movies, they have digital doubles. Mm-hmm. And so the pure virtual characters that they use when they want to throw somebody off a cliff or light somebody on fire, they're all virtual characters, not real. And so to make these virtual characters, what they do is they sit them down in a chair, and then they could sit them down in a chair and pour this goo over their whole face with those straws up their nose so they can breathe, and they let it solidify, and then it's rubbery, and they peel it off, and then from that they get a pore level accuracy map of what their face looks like, all the skin and everything else. And so they take that and make a digital human out of it that you, in static photos, you can't tell the difference between the real one from the fake one, the virtual one. But what happens is when cameras zoom in and out, or the characters move at different distances, the maps that control what things look like. The lighting on the face, on the skin in particular, changes, and so it flickers. And it flickers because you don't have appropriate information for what the light will do at all distances. And so that was my job, was to fix that. And so in particular, Bilbo Baggins, Martin Freeman, his face, I worked on his face, the virtual version of his face, so that it wouldn't flicker in the camera. And making, and well, the software applies to anybody's virtual face, but the test stuff that I was using was on his. And had some success doing that. My stuff worked. It was a lot of computing, and it worked. It reduced flicker markedly, and so I guess they use that, and it's interesting the way they work. They when you develop something and show them that it all works, then they send in a team of their own programmers to translate everything that you've done into their home system. And so I knew it was sufficiently successful when a team of programmers showed up and said, here, show us how this works now. So yeah, okay. So that's what happened. So they were nice enough to give me a credit in the film. And now when you get a credit in film, you have to realize where it's going to appear. It's after the important people, after the hairdresser and the caterer and every, you know, it's way down there in tiny, tiny print, but it's still, hey, it's a credit. So it was
fun. Still incredible in my book. So you've kind of mentioned how your own research has, sorry, you kind of mentioned that it was your students and their interests that kind of led you in this direction. But after you got on a digital arts path, how did that affect the curriculum?
Oh, well, a huge amount, of course, because there were students who wanted to do this, and a number of students, and so they didn't want typically a background in all of the computing details of science. They wanted what amounted to a degree that's a mixture between computer science and art. And art had always been important to me. My father was a fair artist, and he wasn't a professional artist, but he was pretty good at it, amateur, and we always had paintings all over our house when we were growing up. So I was used to being in that, an environment surrounded by art. So looking around and seeing what was available, I looked at other programs and in the country, and there were a couple, but not really very many, that combined science and art. Back in those days, I mean, this was 1998, 97, somewhere in there. Programs were in silos, right? There was this lane and this lane, and you stayed in your lane. You know, if you were an artist, or you were a scientist, you were a left brain person or a right brain person, and you didn't dare try to do the other. And what this really needed was some of both in the same education. So that's why we started building this MFA degree program in computing. It seems very strange at first, but an MFA degree in computing is now fairly, well, at least much more common. And we had to, it was arduous to get that going, because even local curriculum committees, and we had to get approval of computer science department, approval of the art department, approval of both colleges. There were different colleges, you know, keep those silos separate. and then university curriculum committee, and then computer, as you get a new degree, we had Commission on Higher Education, the state CHE had to approve it. And so it needed all these approvals, and at every level I ran into, you know, there were people who were tremendously supportive, and without them it wouldn't have happened, but there were also people who were much opposed to it because it wasn't the way we do things here. In fact, somebody literally said that to me at the university curriculum committee meeting. He said, he looked at it and said, we can't do this. And I said, why not? He said, because this isn't the way we do things at Clemson University. That was his total reasoning. What? So it went through anyway. But that's the kind of opposition I faced. And we finally got it going in 1999. It was approved. And the first graduates, it's a two-year program. And the first graduates appeared in 2001.
Wow.
And they went right into the industry. The very first one that I supervised was Jim Sukup. He went, I said I wasn't going to mention people. But anyway, Jim Sukup went straight to ILM, Industrial Light and Magic, and he had a long career there. So, and subsequent graduate students, there have been many, many graduate students from that program now. And they not only find employment, but they've won lots of awards out there in the industry.
Have any of your students gone on to do surprising things, like things that aren't necessarily what you would have thought they would have done with this degree?
Not that I know of. There are, but you know, I haven't kept up with all of them. I mean, some of the PhD students also did research level work in computer graphics, and so those guys are in the industry in effect also. And so I had 9 or 10 PhD students and 30 some master's students I supervised. And so some of those who were just straight master of science and computer science, but others were MFA in computing. And some of those guys have done fantastic stuff. In particular, they won national awards. Visual Effects Society is kind of the top of the award, and I have one student who's won two of those. Another who won a technical Academy Award for his work, and so it's been very satisfying to have all that come from Clemson and come from our programs. That started with fairly humble beginnings with used furniture and used equipment and space that we begged from the administration, and it became quite an operation. It is now, I believe.
Yeah, I know that there's a summer program at DreamWorks. Can you tell me a little bit about that relationship?
Well, DreamWorks is one we worked with extensively, and they visited, as others have visited many times, on campus and work with the students here, and they had joint programs. I don't know the status of it now, but that has been an ongoing program where they would send researchers here for a while, and they would work on students getting some short clips available that they could then demo in the industry. And of course, no surprise then, the students get hired by DreamWorks fairly quickly. But they've been hired by all the companies in the industry. So we had a lot of help with the people at DreamWorks at the time. And I've visited DreamWorks, a couple of times. And So it opening the discussion is always, when you're talking about interesting problems in computer graphics, it's easy to get people excited about new approaches.
Kind of backtracking a little bit, can you tell me about, I hope I'm saying this correctly, the Techni approach?
The Techni project was hold on a second. I'll be right there. Okay. It was an idea for computer science education, and that is really how the basic computing courses should be taught. And we published some papers on that whole philosophy and it and what was behind it and how it's to be implemented. And so those courses, I don't know whether they're still doing those the way we did them or not. I mean, it's a lot of extra work to do them the way we're doing them. But again, the basic idea was combining computer science with art or creative projects of some kind. So to have one big project instead of the typical computer science intro courses would have tiny little toy projects that weren't really worth anything. It doesn't teach anybody anything to program a grade book. You know, it's useless. So I would in my typical course with data structures in that environment, I would have people write ray tracers. So for industry level images, building images that you couldn't synthetically, that you couldn't tell from real. So something that they had to understand all the science behind the structures that you needed to build these, but then also had to add some creativity in what came out, what's the end. And so it was, again, an idea of combining science with art and big project with instead of toy projects. And so they would have one assignment for the semester. And pieces of it would be due along the way, but it was still one big project that they would have to build on for the semester. So lots of the students really enjoyed that. Others thought it was horrible, but I saw it was always the way. I was able to extend that not just from the intro courses, but up into teaching operating systems as well. And so it became a good source of research in computer science education. We had the computer science special interest groups, rather, are typically where top research is done. They're called the SIGs, special interest groups. And SIG CSE was the one for computer science education. So SIG Graph is for graphics and so on. And SIG CSE was where we published those papers. And it seemed to have really good reception at those places. So we got really good reviews on the papers and good reception at those. So the students who took to the method and the course really enjoyed it, but not all of them did, of course. That's the way it is.
So it sounds like you were kind of an early adopter of interdisciplinary work. Would you agree with that?
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. It's just crucial, and the silos are just artificial. And still around to some extent, but look back to the successes of history, Leonardo da Vinci. We want more, and our present educational system, or at least that was in vogue 20 years ago and maybe 10 years ago, prevents Leonardo da Vinci from doing anything. You have to have these paths available for students to explore what they want to learn and develop creativity and combine science and creativity, left brain and right brain. And I think it's going to become increasingly important, although I would make lots of changes in educational programs there and everywhere else if I had the opportunity, but I haven't been asked to do that.
Well, what if you were? What would be some of the changes you would make?
Well, I shudder at all of the programs at Clemson. I found as I was there, the longer I was there, the standards for what's A work and what's top level work seem to reduce, seem to mm-hmm. be lower and lower and lower, where grades didn't mean anything anymore. And when you look at the olden days at Clemson or any university, what were typical grade point averages, and look now, you'll just be stunned at the difference of the grade inflation. And I argued at the time with the administration about the grade inflation and associated reduction of standards and quality over and over again, but not with any success. But I tried to implement that in my own courses and programs, that people who got A's from me deserved them and showed that they deserved them when they went on to jobs or industry or other schools. And and it's not been just recently either. I mean, if you look back, when I graduated from Duke as an undergraduate, no one, absolutely no one, had a 4.0. There was none. Well, look at Clemson now. Look how many 4.0s there are. Zillions. None. And, I think making everybody an A student so everybody feels good and thinks they're learning something is detrimental to the program and to the students. And they ought to keep the standards high. So, but that's been a lifelong battle with me. So, I would ask for increasing the rigor of all programs.